Hey, good afternoon. Hope you all had some coffee. So, you know, this is, I remember in college, I made sure to have coffee because the afternoon class was always difficult. Post lunch, I'll try to keep it lively. It's interesting. I was hoping that I would get the most attendance for this class because this is most related to what I'm doing in Tanakh. I know the Hirhurim site, the blogspot website, whatever it is, they put my name as teaching the Netziv, which is not at all my specialty, but do that as it may. Anyways, this is the highlight of my day today. So hopefully, it'll be the highlight, one of the highlights of yours as well. In any case, this class is based on a chapter in my new book on Shmot, even though it's on Shoftim. My publisher made me say the book is available, as you know. And remember when my first book came out on Bereishit, I quoted Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who pointed out why he didn't want to speak about his famous article, Rupture and Reconstruction, because he said, why should I work so hard to say in bad English what I've written in good English? So there's something to be said for that here as well. And the book is better than the talk, if for the only reason there's more time to deal with this issue more completely in writing than there is in the context of an hour and 3 minutes, which is what we have left. So this is connected to Shemot, but because the slot is Shoftim, we're going to go through a parallel story in Shoftim, having to deal with fathers-in-law. Before I get into the story in Shoftim, the Givaait, the Pilegesh B'Givaat, the English translation is not completely correct. I mean, it's my own fault, perhaps, but it's difficult to make you know who I'm talking about. Because she's not, the concubine is not from, the Pilegesh is not from, excuse me, the father-in-law is, and the Pilegesh also is not from Giva, right? So it's Pilegesh B'Giva. There's an incident of the Pilegesh, as you all know, in Sefer Shoftim, was brought to Giva and mistreated and killed gruesomely in Giva, but she herself is from Beit Lechem in Yehuda. Okay, so just to clarify that in case anybody's thinking, what a terrible title, how could he write such a thing, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm sure that's why there's not more people in the group. They all were upset that I mislabeled this. But in any case, before I get into the textual analysis, I want to explain where I'm coming from more topically. The way I understand the father-in-law, I understand the father-in-law, the in-law in general, as an introduction into the Jewish vision of the other. Okay, the other is, in certain circles, a very popular word tossed around. Emmanuel Levinas, famous French Jewish philosopher, spoke ad nauseum about this topic. Essentially, the other is the person that's not part of our circle, for whatever reason. Be they foreigners, be they competition, whatever it is. The realities of culture, the realities of human existence are that we have insiders, people who we consider part of our circle, whether it be family circle, whether it be a work circle, community circle, and those who are not part of that circle. The ones that are not part of that circle, we refer to as the other. Now, what does that have to do with in-laws, you might say? So, the whole institution of marriage is something that doesn't have to be. I mean, the procreation doesn't require marriage. There are other possible ways to have children, from simple procreation to incest, all sorts of other possibilities. The Torah prescribes marriage, and by doing so, I mean, not only the Torah, society in general prescribes marriage, and in doing so, creates bonds between people who are strangers, which is an interesting thing to think about. It's not directly related, but that our closest bond is with someone who we only get to know as an adult, generally speaking. There are exceptions, but generally late teens or 20s or 30s or whenever, that's when we meet our spouses. And as a result, we come into this very intimate and close relationship with someone that we have not known. And that creates all sorts of issues. But more importantly for us, it also creates new bonds with in-laws. We create connections with others on a more extended level. And that relationship is a very complex one. And because it's complex, I think, teaches us a lot about how we are able to treat the stranger. Now, when you think about it, in Jewish law, in the Tanakh in particular, in Jewish law in general, the connection between the father-in-law, just to take this, the simplest example, the connection between the father-in-law and the son-in-law is bound to the marriage itself. What I mean by that is, let's say that a man marries a woman, and whatever inheritance that woman would get, right, if she dies, I mean, let's say they have children, but she dies, the husband doesn't really have any part of that inheritance. Same thing vice versa. In other words, the in-law is legally not a part of the family. He's only a part of the family so long as he's married to the in-law. That's expressed very nicely, by the way, in the opposite situation in Megillat Rut. Find the right place. Again, bring out your Tanakhs. In the first parak in Rut, it's a very telltale phrase where Naomi, I'm looking at Pasuk Yud Aleph and Yud Bet, after Naomi's daughters-in-law lose their husbands, so she basically tells them there's no reason for you to stay with me, which is, I think, illustrating the point very well that I'm trying to show you. It says, "V'tomer Naomi, shov na benotai, lama telchena imi, ha'od li banim b'ma'ai, v'yu lechem la'anashim." And she continues, "Shov na benotai lechen, ki zekanti miyot le'ish, ki amati yesh li tikva, gam ha'iti halila le'ish, v'gam iladti banim." Ha'iti halila le'ish, I'm sorry, gam iladti banim. So I don't have any more boys for you. And therefore, since I have no more boys for you, there's no reason to continue this relationship because the relationship doesn't exist. If you're not married to my sons, then who are we but strangers? And again, it may sound like a very stark and unusual way to look at it, but clearly in the Tanakh's worldview, and I think this is expressed in Jewish law as well, the child-in-law, be it the daughter-in-law, be it the son-in-law, is only a part of family as long as they're married to our child. So long as, I'm not speaking about a marriage being dissolved in divorce, but more likely, as in the case of Ruth, when the spouse dies, not only does that relationship become dissolved, but so does the relationship, at least in a formal sense, that no one says you can't be friends, but there's no relationship beyond the friendship that you might have with any other person formally. Again, I'm not saying it's not a nice thing, but formally there's no relationship that exists between the parent-in-law and the child-in-law.
And Ruth and Orpah have had children, wouldn't they then have been
married? Because they would have been grandchildren. Yeah, okay, perhaps. But let's put that on the side. I think one of the nice thing is that we're taking out all the variables. And the fact that they don't have children, which eliminates any other possible variable, shows us that without anything else, but in of themselves, the child-in-law is not connected.
So let's say Ruth belongs to no family, since what she's been given to her husband's family doesn't belong to her.
Okay, that's a problem for Ruth.
Right.
And Orpah, you're right. But be that as it may, whatever problems that comes up, I'm just describing the situation. Now, this is also, I think, to be noted in the relationship between Moshe and Yitro, which we'll discuss at greater length. When Moshe asked to leave Yitro, we'll refer to this more than once, so you might want to put your finger in there, in Parshat Shmot, in Pasuk, in Perek Dalet, in Pasuk Yud Chet. So the way Moshe asks to return to Mitzrayim, in this case, to go back to his Jews, it says like this: V'yilech Moshe v'yishev al yeter chotno v'yomer lo elchana v'ashuva el achai asher b'Mitzrayim v're ha'odam chayim v'yom yitro l'Moshe lech l'shalom. Next, the last part of the passage will be important later on. But what I wanted to focus, what I pronounced with more emphasis, was la'achai, right? For by Moshe saying that he's going la'achai, who's excluding? Right? He's leaving one place, right? So who is he excluding? He's excluding Yitro. He's excluding his father. I'm going back. I mean, he's not going just to his brothers. He only had one, as far as we know. Achai is my achai in the more general sense. I'm going back to my brothers, right? The soul brothers, my family. Right, you're not my family, and this terms of discourse are used between Moshe and Yitro more than once. Later on, when Yitro decides to leave, there also it's clear that it's not a question of Yitro staying with his family. I mean, his daughter and his children, yes, but as far as Moshe and the Jewish people, they are not Yitro's family, and we'll get into that more as we go ahead. The topic, the textual analysis we're really looking at is what I call the father-in-law light scene. I'll explain that term a little bit later, but the first term, father-in-law, you all understand. And I want to ask you to think back on how many fathers-in-law do we see discussed in any detail in the Tanakh. You're not giving me numbers. Give me Lavan. So Lavan is one, right? So the other one, Moshe, we already spoke about, and there's a third one which should be obvious from Tamar and Yehuda. So I'm looking for the opposite combination. I'm looking for the I'm looking for the son-in-law of as Tamar is Yehuda's daughter-in-law. I'm looking right now for a father-in-law with a son-in-law, but what you're saying is correct. Any other fathers-in-law? So we have, Yaakov and Lavan was mentioned. We have Moshe and Yitro, the Pilegish from the title. Anyone else?
David and Shaul.
Good. Okay, David Shaul is important. Anyone else? The other one that I can think of is Noach and his sons-in-law. There's not a lot of discussion there.
Noah has three sons.
He has daughters. Lot. Yeah. Right. Yeah. These are the major ones that we can think of. We're going to focus on two of them, and the reason I'm not just going to shoot darts, I'm going to ask you how many people, we've mentioned five, how many people are described as a choten, as a father-in-law? Yitro is famous, right? Because choten Moshe, right? That's his nickname, right? We're going to get into nicknames because I think it's an important part of the shiur. Who else? I wouldn't expect you to know. The other person is the hero of today's shiur, the anonymous father of the anonymous woman, who's married to the anonymous man. And Shoftim, people are not that important as individuals, more as examples of general themes. But in spite of that, we're going to go through that story, and we're going to note the usage of the word choten, right, the word father-in-law. And one question that should make us think is, why is it that these two people are described as father-in-law, whereas Shaul is not, whereas Lot is not? And by the way, those two, certainly Lot is a minor character. Shaul and David already requires some explanation. But perhaps what requires the most explanation is Lavan. Why does it require more explanation? Because he's a major character. Certainly his son-in-law is a major character. He appears quite a few more times than Yitro. In fact, I think if I remember from the concordance, he appears about twice as many times as Yitro and Chovav and all the other names for Moshe's father-in-law. So that's our question. Why? There can be different explanations, but in my study of Tanakh, epithets, meaning the way a person's referred to, has tremendous importance. In other words, we can be referred to by many different ways, and the Tanakh clearly chooses how to call a person in different situations. As we can be described by our name, obviously, but we can also be described by a relationship. We're a brother of someone, with a husband or a wife of someone else. And by the way, a person, there's a whole variety of names that can be used, because we are simultaneously the husband and the father and the son and the brother, right? So the question is, which relationship are we emphasizing? And the Torah will emphasize the same person's relationship to different people at different points in time. Right? For example, Miriam is sometimes Achot Aaron, right? Sometimes Achot Moshe. Right? Why is that? Because of the context. In some cases it's more important to know this brother, in some cases it's more important to know the other brother. What other ways can we refer to people besides relationships and names? Anything else that you find in Tanakh?
The place.
Right, the nationality, right? And in the case of Lavan, that comes out quite a few times, right? Lavan Arami, Hagar Mitzri, right? There are certain people that are closely associated with their nation. That also. Okay, good. So the question is, why is the Tanakh interested in focusing, in connecting these people with their nations? Okay, so again, I think we'll get back to that in the case of Yitro. But right now what we're looking at is not so much relationships or nationalities. What we're looking at is the epithet of Choten, of being the father-in-law. We're going to start with this, with the story in Shoftim. And we'll take a look at what it has to say about the... And so we're going to look at the part of the story that's less well-known, right? Everybody knows the first part of the story, the second part of the story, the gruesome, disgusting, violent, but people, you know, that's what people like, so people remember that part. But the first part of the story is less interesting, so people don't speak a lot about it. So let's take a look at it together. We're looking at Perek Yud Tet, I think from the beginning, if I'm not mistaken. From the first pasuk, we'll translate it intermittently. Okay, this story begins. V'yabiyamim ha'hem u'melech ein b'Yisrael v'yish Levi gar b'yarchete ha'refraim. Right, so this man took a pilegesh, a concubine, a half-wife, if you want to call it that, from Yehuda, as we mentioned before, from Beit Lechem. V'tizne alav pilegsho, v'telech meito Beit Avia el Beit Lechem Yehuda, v'tehi sham yamim arba'a chodeshim. She did something that was unsightly, literally means strayed. Commentaries say that doesn't mean sexual improprieties in this case, but be that as it may, whatever it is, she did something that didn't find favor in the eyes of her husband, and she went away from him back to her father's home. In any case, in Pasuk Gimel, V'yakom isha v'yelech achareya ledaber liba la'shiva v'naro imo v'tzemed hamurim v'teviyehu beit aviyah v'yirehu aviyah nara v'ismach likhato. So now I want you to start paying attention to how the father of this woman is referred to as we go along in this story. In any case, he comes, the husband comes back and wants to bring her back. He speaks to her heart, right, brings various things. And the father of the Nara, the father of this young woman, sees him and he is happy to greet him. V'chazek bo chotno, avi ha-Nara, v'yashev ito shloshet yamim, v'yochlu v'yishtu v'yalinu sham. Right, so he's happy and they eat and they drink for 3 days. Pasuk hevi biyom ha-revi'i v'yashkimu baboka v'yakom lelechet v'yome avi ha-Nara. El chatano sa'ad libecha pat lechem v'acha telechu. So the father says, the morning, this is the fourth day, in the morning they're ready to go, and he says, no, don't go, right? Have some more food, and then you can go. V'yeshvu v'yochlu shnehem yachta v'yishtu v'yimu avi ha'nara la'ish hoel na v'lin v'yitev libcha. So the father pleads with him again to stay longer, to eat some more, and to stay the night, which he apparently does. V'yakom ha'ish lelechet v'yitzar bo chotno v'yashav v'yilen sham. So in the meantime, the husband wants to go, and the father is mafsir. What's mafsir? He pleads with him. Right? He pleads with him to stay another night, and the husband gives in, and in fact stays there another night. Okay, this is the fifth day now. In pasuk chet, v'yashkem b'boker b'yom chamishi lelechet v'yomer avi ha'nara sa'ad na levavcha v'hit mahamahu ad natot hayom v'yochlu shnehem. So the father, it's the fifth day in the morning, and the father says, what do you expect him to say? Stay and eat, right? Have another meal, right? And they stayed a while, until it started getting late in the afternoon. Both of them were eating. V'yakom ha'ish lelechet hu pilagsho v'naro v'yom alochotno avi ha'nara hinena rafa yom la'arov linu na hine hanot hayom lin po v'yitav lufa v'shkamtem macha ledachichem v'alachta lo'olecha. He pleads to him to stay one more night. Stay one more night. And this time the husband says, that's enough. Velo ava ha'ish lalun ve'yakom ve'ylech ve'yavo ad nochach yavus hi Yerushalayim ve'imot semed hamurim chavushim pilagsho imo. And you know the rest of the story, right? But the point is, we have this very repetitive sort of narrative where the father-in-law keeps on pleading. He's feeding and sleeping and feeding and sleeping ad nauseum, and finally at the end of the story the son-in-law is allowed to leave, and unfortunately it ends up tragically. But as I said to you before, if you follow through the scenario, through the scene, there are two ways the father-in-law is described. What are the two ways? Choten, right? And avi ha'nara, right? So he has two identities. He's two people in one, right? And generally, both terms are used. There's one place where only the word choten is used. Where is that? That's right. In pasuk zayin, viv sarbo chotno. Okay, so perhaps that's important. I think certainly in terms of the patterns that we'll see, it may well be important. But in any case, you have this person who, the essential scene that's going on is a son-in-law trying to depart from his father-in-law, right, which comes after spending time together, which involves eating and sleeping. And there's some sort of leave-taking going on. Okay, and that's identified very strongly, not only with the father of a daughter, but more importantly for our purposes, with a choten, with a father-in-law, right? Where else do we see this scene played out? Okay, Lavan, right? So before he's chasing, what happens before that? Yaakov asks to leave, right? Yaakov asks to leave also after spending much time with his father-in-law. who's not a father-in-law, because it's not described as such. Where else? Where else do we have a leave-taking of a son-in-law? Yitro Moshe, which we just discussed, right? Yitro Moshe, sorry? Lot? Okay. Yes, okay. We'll just say yes for now. Where else? Very interesting. You mentioned Moshe and Yitro, but it's not only Moshe and Yitro, it's also Yitro and Moshe. Right? Moshe, right, it's a reversal where Yitro. That's right. And that is very interesting, as we'll discuss what it means to be a father-in-law. We'll see that on some level Moshe becomes a father-in-law to Yitro. But be that as it may, we'll get to that. This is a what Robert Alter refers to as a type scene. Right, those of you familiar with his work, a type scene, which is actually something he borrows from studies in Homer and general Western literature, is a convention, a scene that's expected in a certain situation. Right, for example, he speaks about meeting your wife at the well. Right, where are you supposed to meet your wife? At the well, obviously, and there's a certain ritual that happens at the well. You can read what he has to say about that. His main point, however, is that even though the scene repeats itself because it's a convention, the way the Torah and the Tanakh as a whole uses that convention is to make slight and sometimes not so slight differences between the scenes. And from those differences come tremendous meaning. Now, the Torah is trying to get our attention to what's different about this scene. Right? He uses an example from Westerns in his book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, that the scene is the showdown where the sheriff is always quicker than the bad guy. Right? He says 10 out of 11 cases, that's what you have. And the 11th case, you have someone without one arm, but instead he has a rifle that he throws up with his left arm and shoots. Right? So what's the point? So the point is, that guy is really special. Right, so you're supposed to notice that it's not just going through the regular convention, but rather it's an alteration of the convention. No pun intended. Alteration. In any case, I use the word light scene as opposed to type scene because, as in with a leitmotif, the fact that it exists in certain places, I think, tries to, like a leitmotif and like a leitvort, which is a milah manche in Hebrew, it's connecting disparate elements. In fact, to use Alter's words about motifs, it serves to, these are my words, his words are, that they're there to establish interactive connections between seemingly disparate episodes. So what I'm trying to say is the fact that this scene appears in the places we mentioned, twice with Yitro and Moshe, once with the Pilegesh Begiva, and with Lavan, to a lesser extent with Lot, but we'll keep that on the side for now. The fact that these things occur in these different situations are not simply for us to see the differences, but also to note that there is such a convention, and the convention is appropriate in these scenarios. Right? Lavan being a counterexample, obviously, and we'll get to that, which is more what Alter is talking about, because there, by Lavan, we have variations on very serious and unusual variations on this theme. Okay, so let's look at the differences between. We mentioned before we wanted to know why these people are known as fathers-in-law. Why is Lavan not known as a father-in-law? And the Torah, I think, goes out of its way to show us exactly why Lavan is not referred to as a choten. He's referred to as all sorts of other things, right? Father of this person, the son of this person, the Arami. But he's not even once referred to as father-in-law. Let's look at the contrast, right? Yaakov wants to marry Lavan's daughters, right? So how does that work out? Yaakov has to give a lot in order, a lot of time, a lot of work, right? What does Yitro ask for Moshe in terms of dowry, in terms of servitude? Anything? No, he offers just the opposite. He offers his daughter. We don't hear about any conditions, right? When Yaakov asks to leave, right, so what happens? Right, doesn't get permission. Not only doesn't he get permission, when he actually leaves, what happens? He's chased. Now there's a similar chase with Yitro. Yitro also chases after Moshe. Right? When does he chase after Moshe? He doesn't really chase, but he comes back to Moshe. Right? Right? And what is Lavan trying to do? What is Lavan doing? What is Moshe trying to do? Lavan's trying to take away Yaakov's family, and Yitro bring back Moshe's family. Right? When Lavan finally catches up with Yitro, so there is some sort of peace settlement made, but the terms are such that the God of Yaakov is recognized, but there's also a place for the God of Lavan, right? As opposed to Yitro, who comes to Moshe giving sacrifices to Moshe's God. Now you may tell me, well, wasn't also Yitro's God? And the answer to that is, wait a few more minutes and we'll talk about that. That's the controversial part of the class. So keep tuned.
You also have the agreement that not to cross over, don't cross over here, and I don't cross over there.
Right. Right.
That's also the difference with Yitro. There's nothing about.
Okay, there's no boundary lines. No. Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. So what comes out from this contrast is Lavan being used as a counterpoint to Yitro. In other words, before we can find out who is a choten, we have to find out who is not. We have to find out that there can be this relationship in such a way that the person does not act in such a way that the Tanakh, the Torah, can describe it as a choten, as a father-in-law. As yes, Yaakov is married to Lavan's daughter, but that doesn't make him into a father-in-law in the Tanakh. Right? Why not? Because of the contrasts we described. As a father-in-law, like the father of the Pelegesh and Givah, takes care of the son-in-law, rejoices in him, is friendly to him, offers good advice, right? Yitro is known for his advice. The advice of the father-in-law Shoftim proves to be prophetic. Right? The advices don't go. Right? Of course, if he had let him go earlier, maybe things would have been different. But be that as it may, the last advice, for better or worse, was good advice. And the father-in-law is generally looking for the best interest of the son-in-law. That's what a father-in-law is. That's what we see in Pelegesh B'Givah. That's what we see by Yitro and Moshe. That's what we see the opposite of by Lavan and Yaakov. By the way, that also helps us understand by David and Shaul, right? David and Shaul, even though both are tzaddikim, we're told, right? Nonetheless, there's bad blood. And if there's bad blood, he's not a father-in-law. Again, Michal, Merav may be Shaul's daughters who are married to David, but that doesn't make him a father-in-law. So there's a little more to it than what we've just spoken about. And that has to do with what we spoke about before. Because what I'm suggesting is that the father-in-law, or the son-in-law, is the Torah's way of telling us how we should relate to the other. Because as we mentioned at the beginning of the shiur, the son-in-law, or the father-in-law, is an other that we happen to know, but remains an other because he's not really part of our family. But the question is how you treat such a person. So we've seen already that one should treat them nicely. Perhaps that's no surprise. But I think the scene that we described as a light scene, again, which I'm proposing, is defining how a father-in-law or how a person should relate to another, to the other, is focused on the very last part of the requesting to leave from the father-in-law. The very last part is the acquiescence. Son-in-law says, I would like to leave. And what does Yitro says? He gives him a brachat. We saw before, right, in Perek Dalet. What does the father-in-law in Giva do? Or in Beit Lechem? He allows him to leave, right? Even when it's not necessarily, as in this case, in their own best interest. In other words, besides kindness, there's also respect for autonomy. The son-in-law is recognized as autonomous. Compare that again to Lavan. Lavan is not a father-in-law. He's the father of Yaakov's children. Why is he only the father and not the father-in-law? Because he doesn't respect, it's not just that he's not kind, he does not respect Yaakov's autonomy. Ultimately, and it's very interesting, there are other parallels between, which are not directly related to this class, but there are other parallels between Lavan, it's another discussion in my book, between Lavan and Yitro. The most important here is they're not only father-in-laws, in this case they're also employers. They're, Lavan is not only Yaakov's father-in-law, he's also his boss, as is Yitro. Right? They happen to be shepherds. There are many parallels. But what's interesting and important here is that Lavan is treating Yaakov like an unfortunate necessity. In other words, I have a daughter, and the problem with having a daughter is you have to find them someone to marry. But I want to have as little to do with him as possible. And since I'm the one with the power, then I'm going to use that power to his disadvantage as much as possible. That's always the case in classical times, that the father-in-law is more powerful, right? Because he's older, generally more established, right? In our cases, he's the one who lives within his culture, right? Yaakov and Moshe are both living in foreign cultures, so they have tremendous advantages, right? Even in this mini story of Shoftim, right? The man of Levi is coming to where? Is coming to Beit Lechem. He's not in his turf. The father-in-law has the advantage, right? And the father-in-law, in theory, like Lavan, can use that advantage against the son-in-law. You say, you're not leaving here, right? Who says you're leaving? What does Lavan say? Lo sim ken b'mikomenu. We don't do that in our place. Right? The son-in-law just leaves? Who heard of such a thing? Yeah. Yeah.
The attitude is very different there.
How so?
Well,
because he gives a bracha. He gives
a bracha. And they allow her to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting. I haven't thought about it. I'm just going to.
Why did he take over that role when he should have been the father in law? Something that made him be the father.
That's one thing, but I think Andy's suggesting that there he was a lot kinder. He was a soft, as gentler, kinder Lavan, because he, after all, he gives a bracha, and he doesn't imprison Eved Avraham, whoever it is.
Eved Avraham comes with a fortune.
Yeah. Also, okay. Okay. So, okay. So that could be, that probably would be the most obvious answer. My thought off the cuff was that just as tzaddikim develop into tzaddikim, rasha'im also develop into rasha'im. And that, you know, there was a softer, gentler Lavan. Not that he was gentle, not that he was soft, but he was better. It's interesting. It's worth looking into, and I'll have to do some homework and let you know what I think about that.
Aren't both cases of Lavan and Moshe anomalous for that society, because at marriage, a girl should go to her husband's house.
Yeah.
The husband should
yeah.
be living in right. his wife's house. So it's already an odd situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, but perhaps.
And that's why Lavan let her go. That's what you're supposed. Girls are supposed to go.
They're supposed to. Fine, but Okay, it could be that it's simply that's what people do, which in fact I think supports what we're saying, that that's what a father-in-law does, that they're supposed to be elsewhere, they're not supposed to be in his home.
No, that a daughter is supposed to be centered. You're not really supposed to have a son-in-law.
Right,
in your
okay, right.
Your daughter should be.
Correct, correct. Okay, so that a correct father-in-law will go along with that pattern, whereas someone who is not going along with the Tanakh's paradigm of father-in-law.
Yeah, knew that eventually his daughter
would be. Correct, correct. Okay, and we're saying that that's the respect for autonomy that the Tanakh is interested in setting up paradigm of father-in-law, but more broadly, of setting up relations between ourselves and the other. In other words, the proper relationship between the inner circle and the outer circle is not just one of kindness, but ultimately, and perhaps most importantly, one of recognition of autonomy, of recognizing that the other person has the right to follow their decisions, their feelings, their way of looking at things. And we're going to strengthen that a little bit more by saying something that may be a little controversial. I mentioned before that perhaps it's no surprise that Yitro worshipped and gave sacrifices to our God, to Moshe's God, whereas Lavan brought his God in. I said, well, that was very nice of Yitro that he left his God out in Midian and didn't bring it in. But we all know Rashi, who tells us that, in fact, Yitro converted. But I'm not so sure that it's the simplest interpretation of what happened. And I'll tell you why. We talked about epithets before. We talked about ways of... So we mentioned three things, three ways to call people: names, family relationships, and nations. But we left one other way of referring to a person, Tanakh. Maybe there's... Sorry?
His job.
Excellent. Okay? So Yitro has two nicknames, right? One is Hoten Moshe. The other one is his job. What's that? Kohen Midian. Okay? Kohen Midian. And that name is a little bit problematic, right? Because Kohen normally means what? Priest, okay? So we know that in Shmuel, if you want to take a look, in Shmuel Bet, in Perek Chet, Pasuk Yud Chet, there's a reference to Bnei David as being Kohanim. Obviously, they're not Kohanim. In the traditional sense, they're not priests, or it's very unlikely that they're priests, and generally understood as officers. Okay, so could be, it's theoretically possible, that's the usage being employed here. However, in context, it doesn't seem very likely. This happens to be a machloket in the Mechilta, the Pasuk in Perek Yud Chet, Pasuk Aleph, you can look it up. There are two opinions, brought down the Malbim as well. There are two opinions as to what Kohen Midian means. One is the one we just mentioned, that it just means an officer. And the other one is that he's a priest. Okay? So if Yitro is a priest of Midian, that creates a tremendous disparity between these people who are getting along so well. Right? By the way, you might say, well, he wasn't Midian, but once he heard about Har Sinai, right, so he converted, certainly by that point. Problem is that the name Kohen Midian just doesn't drop. Right? In fact, one could make the case, depending on how exacting one is about language, one could make the case that the identity of Kohen Midian became stronger. Because when it's mentioned earlier, when Moshe's there at the beginning of Sefer Shemot, so he's referred to as Chotno, Kohen Midian. Later on, when Yitro comes back to Moshe to bring back Tzipora and his children, so all of a sudden, remember, pay attention to the expression. Before it was Choten, Chotno, Kohen Midian, and now he becomes Kohen Midian, Choten Moshe. Right, so I think it's reasonable to suggest, not necessarily the case, but it's reasonable to suggest that there's a switch of prioritization, whereas primary identity in the desert was that of Chot and Moshe. Now his primary identity, now that Moshe hasn't been around, Right? Similar to what Chazal say about Hagar. Hagar, when she's in Avram's tent, is monotheistic. Right? When she's outside of Avram's tent, she goes back to idol worship. So one could say that Moshe has an influence when he's with Yitro. When Moshe's away, he reverts back to making Kohen Midian his primary identity. So, why is all that important? Why am I discussing that? Because I think the Torah is trying to make as strong a case as possible for the identity of the other. I mean, the other is not just someone who is pretty similar to us. He goes to the other shul, right? He lives across the street. The other is a Kohen Midian. The other is an idolater. And that strengthens, if that's the case, that makes all the more strong the fact that Yitro is willing to put his idols by the wayside, as opposed to Lavan, who brings his idols with him when he encounters his son-in-law adversary. When Yitro encounters his son-in-law, he leaves his own preferences at the gate. Right? Moshe is aware that he's an idolater, according to this reading. And nonetheless, Moshe also, just like Yitro, is mechabed, right? Because as I said before, what is the father-in-law as opposed to the son-in-law? The father-in-law is the other that's connected through marriage, the powerful one of the two, right? When Moshe goes to marry Tzipora, so he's the standard son-in-law because he's the one without the power. He's not his culture. He's not wealthy. He's not powerful. Yitro is powerful, wealthy, or presumably powerful, certainly has means, and is within his own culture. But then the Torah does a fascinating switch, right, to show the reciprocality of the relationship, where all of a sudden Moshe is, quote-unquote, the father-in-law, because, not because he's the father, but because he's powerful, because he's wealthy, apparently, and because he's living within his own culture. And he treats Yitro the same way as Yitro treated him. Because the Tanakh is telling us that's how you treat the other. So, what I'm saying is that the leitmotif, the light scene of father-in-laws is trying expressively to tell us how we need to deal with people who are not part of our circle. You need to learn from someone you have something to do with. Right? The person who's an other and you never see, it doesn't exist for all intents and purposes. The other that exists is the one you see, the other in your family. And that's really ultimately what the son-in-law is. Now, one more point, probably more than one more point, but there's one point I want to make, and that is the question of whether Yitro converted or not. Again, I think that the Shior stands without. There are other distinctions between Moshe and Yitro, certainly their age, their culture, even without religious differences, there's certainly cultural differences that they're able to work around or work through in creating a harmonious relationship. But this issue of whether he converted or not, I think, is significant in another regard. And by the way, had Yitro in fact converted, one wonders why he's not really the paradigm. Who's the paradigm of the convert? Ruth. Ruth comes later. So if Yitro is in fact a ger, right? So why don't we learn the halachas of gerut from Yitro? Again, I'm not saying that I'm necessarily right, but I think it's certainly a direction we should entertain. And if it is in fact correct, what the Tanakh ends up doing is creating a much more universal paradigm. In other words, someone who accepts our faith community becomes an insider. They're no longer the other. They're now part of us. As a result, we don't learn how to treat the other from the outsider that becomes an insider. Right? And by the way, if you looked at the discussion between Moshe and Yitro, later in Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bamidbar. By the way, it's not 100% clear that Yitro goes back to Midian, but it appears, most Mepharshim learn that he goes back to Midian, which, if you learn that he never converted, makes a lot of sense. Right? If you learn that he converted, right, it's very difficult. You know Rashi's answer, right? Why did he go back to Midian? To Megayer Gerim. Okay? But it's a stretch. And you only say that if you're stuck into a position such as that which Rashi takes, that Yitro converted. But I think it, again, I think it's worth entertaining the possibility that he did not. And certainly if he didn't, as I said before, it creates a much more interesting paradigm for us in, as to how far we should be willing to stretch in terms of our relationship with someone else, right? If it's true of a polytheist, right? Obviously, I'm not talking halakha, there are halakhic issues. But in theory, if this is true of how we need to relate to a polytheist, to a pagan, then al chad kama v'kama to a monotheist or to another Jew, right, who doesn't necessarily share our vision.
Could you say that the reason Laban insisted on introducing his own God as a parting is that there was an attempt to steal his front being? In other words, in both directions, there wasn't respect.
That's interesting.
And good. He thought Yaakov did it, of course, so he really convinced.
Okay. Could be. I mean, in other words, the seeds you sow end up creating the sort of reciprocal relationship. That's definitely true. Tov, we've seen the story in Shoftim as the basis for what a father-in-law needs to do. Question of harmony, of simcha, of taking care of the other person, of giving good advice, and we know Yitro is famous for his advice more than anything else, but ultimately of allowing the in-law, the son-in-law, to decide whether to take that advice or not, which, by the way, is also reciprocated by Moshe, who also gives advice to his father-in-law to stay with the Jewish people, right? That will be good for Yitro, who's also given the autonomy and the privilege to be his own person, to decide whether he wants to stay or not. And finally, this paradigm of how to treat the other is taken, as far as I'm concerned, to the limit by showing that really it can apply not only to people who we see eye to eye with, but even more by people who we're completely different from. There can't be any greater difference. We talked about Yitro's epithet as Kohen Midian. One of the epithets of Moshe is Ish HaElokim, right? So this is a fascinating combination, right? From one extreme to the other, of Kohen Midian, the pagan priest, right? It's not just a pagan, but he's on top. He's the Pope, right? Kohen Midian on the one hand, and Ish HaElokim on the other. And no one's talking about, you know, interfaith services. What we're talking about is, how do you treat them? How do you deal with them? The world is going to have people that are like this. And again, I think that one can find serious and very real indications in the text based on the father-in-law paradigm as exactly how we're supposed to treat the other. Okay, there's a couple minutes left. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Welcome to... Okay, thanks very much. Again, copies of the book are available here in the dining room.